Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes. The yellow smoke that rubs its muzzle on the window panes. Licked its dung into the corners of the evening, lingered upon the pools that stand in drains, let fall upon its back the soot that falls from chimneys, slipped by the terrace, made a sudden leap, and seeing that it was a soft October night, curled once about the house and fell asleep. And indeed there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions, and for 100 visions and revisions, before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair, with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say, how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all already, known them all, have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase. And when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways? And how should I presume? And I have known the arms already, known them all, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight down with light brown hair. Is it perfume from a dress that makes me so digress? Arms that lie along a table or wrap about a shawl. And should I then presume? And how should I begin? Shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. And the afternoon, the evening, sleeps so peacefully, smoothed by long fingers, asleep, tired, or it malingers, stretched on the floor here beside you and me. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? But though I have wept and fasted, wept and prayed, though I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter. I am no prophet, and here's no great matter. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker. And in short, I was afraid. And would it have been worth it after all? After the cups, the marmalade, the tea, among the porcelain, among some talk of you and me, would it have been worthwhile to have bitten off the matter with a smile, to have squeezed the universe into a ball, to roll it toward some overwhelming question, to say, I am Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all, I shall tell you all. If one, settling a pillow by her head, should say, that is not what I meant at all, that is not it at all. And would it have been worth it, after all? Would it have been worthwhile, after the sunsets and the dooryards and the sprinkled streets, after the novels, after the teacups, after the skirts that trail along the floor, and this and so much more? It is impossible to say just what I mean, but as if a magic lantern threw the nerves in patterns on a screen. Would it have been worthwhile if one, settling a pillow or throwing off a shawl and turning toward the window, should say, that is not it at all, that is not what I meant at all? No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. Am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince. No doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence but a bit obtuse, at times indeed, almost ridiculous, almost at times the fool. I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back when the wind blows the water white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown till human voices wake us and we drown.
Eliot's speaker is using the imagery to denote a march away from the garden. This is Garden of Eden. This is also the primeval garden of prehistory. Somehow history is the antithesis of what it means to exist and have a sense of living in a fulfilled way. The direct experience of the congregation of man, if you will, is in the darkness, is lost behind the veil of the smoke that rises. Well, it might be helpful to differentiate between what I meant when I said humanity and refer to that instead as humanness and leave the question of humanity to be answered in regards to this march of history, this walk away from the garden. We see Well, we the readers see or can see adumbrations or hints towards a further walk away from innocence. However, nowhere to my mind is this made more absolute. Nowhere in the poem is it clearer than in the final couplet, where Eliot's speaker finally states, "We have lingered in the chambers of the sea, next to sea girls wreathed in seaweed, red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown." Well, if you think about the poem in terms of binary comparisons, we have these images of the dirty streets, the cityscape versus this interior landscape of desire and impetus to act according to our original nature. And in those final lines, in the final couplet, what do we see appear there but a comparison, a juxtaposition of seagulls wreathed in seaweed, red and brown. And we have, in that single statement, we have seaweed, the color of which we might associate as green, and then red and brown. Okay, so green, red, brown. And the image, of course, of the sea, blown white and black. So we have all of these colors, and what happens to the colors? What happens to the ones who linger in the sea with them? They are awakened by human voices, okay? These human voices are like the echoes of the muttering retreats that the poem begins with. These are the voices of history. These are the voices that forward the notions of the institutions that surround Eliot's speaker in the city of London, the Edwardian gentleman, the situation in which this Edwardian speaker is situated. So we have earth tones, green, red, brown, black, white. These are all earth tones set in juxtaposition to the sudden intrusion of these human voices. So I think when I said I wanted to differentiate between humanness and humanity, that I would link humanness to the genetic, maybe more naturalistic impulses of our earlier adumbration, earlier manifestation of community, ideas of what it meant to be human in living in concert with all the biosphere. So that is our humanness, our basic, the ground level basic earthliness about us. And humanity thus would be the opposite end of that binary polarization, being history, or if you want to think of it as a cultural slow burn, like a culturally slowly burning shift into a new modality whereby lines are demarcated. So we have straight lines, we have city streets set in straight lines, we have buildings which cut into the atmosphere with sharp edges, and everything is ordered, 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 until we have lost the places, the liminal places, in other words, the places between that connect us to the rest of our world, which Eliot Speaker perhaps, well, perhaps underlying what Eliot Speaker is saying is that we have a sort of organismic totality that we ignore by heading in the direction in which we are heading. So we have this binary of genetic versus epigenetic activities. Genetic versus epigenetic activities. Epigenetic activities are the ordered self-propelling mechanistic, in other words, machine-oriented movements into time that we see now. So we have a mechanistic epigenetic end, which I call humanity, set in juxtaposition to the genetic humanness of the totality of the organism of the earth. And the speaker in the poem is describing in a way this planetary crisis that we have had brought ourselves to at this point in 1910, Edwardian England. If you want to think of the image of the malingering cat, the malingering gentleman who lay upon the couches in the parlor rooms smoking and thinking. This is the other problem that I think the speaker is trying to enunciate, which is that we are somehow stuck in these cycles of thought, of thinking. The problem of not being able to act due to overanalyzing any given situation. Do I dare disturb the universe? You know, these questions we ask ourselves, well, what if I fail? Right? We have this callow gentleman. If I had to boil down the problem that the speaker is having, the problem that by extension the rest of the population surrounding him is having in the poem, I would call it callow. This one word, callow, means technically inexperienced, immature. But the word callow is derived from the Latin word calvus, which means bald. So I have seen my head grown slightly bald, brought in upon a platter. I think in a way, whether intentionally or otherwise, Eliot's somehow punning here with this image, because this certainly the speaker seems to be immature and inexperienced in his assumptions about women, for instance, his lack of courage to say what he really means, to do anything about the problems he is enunciating, this lack of following through, this lack of courage to follow through with his observations, his beliefs, and what is going on. He simply lingers around like the smoke. He lingers around the parlor rooms and watches people and mutters to himself about these issues, but he never gets there. He never does anything about them. Eliot's love song of J. Alfred Prufrock also seems to suggest a kind of slow death that occurs in the world that he is illustrating in the poem. So, there will be time to meet the faces that you meet, time to make a face to meet the faces that you meet. And this sense of perpetually delaying the future, right? So we have done everything that we're told to do, and here we are in the living room, and here we are. I'm with a woman, and she's with me, And now what? Right? There's this, okay, what about the actual experiences that life somehow wants to live, right? So there's this interior landscape of decay, as well as this exteriorization of a slow like journey. So we have the sense that the speaker is strolling through the streets early in the morning and just watching things and people and thinking, right? So again, the thinking. We're thinking all the time, and we're talking to ourselves in our mind, and there is this slow decay. This repetition, the repetition, I think, also is part of this suggestion. So we have there will be time, there will be time. We have in the room, the women come and go. Of course, the refrain is re repeated. Further questions. Should I, after tea and cakes and ices, have the strength to force the moment to its crisis? So, again, I feel this is another pun on Eliot's behalf, where we have this crisis. Now, the crisis is one of a loss of connection to others, the loss of community, the loss of community that happened due to the Victorian, well, and arguably earlier, but certainly in the Victorian era, we have the sudden cutting off from other families, even in the community. We have the idea, an ideal of the nuclear family is born, and we have parlor rooms, and we have landed aristocracies and a working class, and we have a kitchen now to read the newspaper in the morning. So we spend our time reading about what happens to everyone else, but we never actually get to commune with anyone else. This is this part of this slow walk away from the garden, this stroll of slow decay of time that happens one frame at a time in the poem. Well, some of you guys, some of my students in my AP class might recall from earlier in the school year my mentioning that where the College Board compilers of the AP Literature and Composition test choose to end a given passage is highly significant and should be closely looked at, closely analyzed, because where the passage ends is significant, where they choose to stop citing that text is significant. Well, the same is true of writers and most especially poets, and is perhaps doubly or quadruply so true and significant where an author chooses to stop writing, or it chooses and decides the text is done. So let's look again one last time at the end of The Love Song of Geoffrey Prufrock. We have the story, if you want to think of it in narrative terms. We have again, the slow walk out of the city, and we end, or we come here to our end, and we're on a beach, and we have the old man who has grown old. He has grown old, and it's kind of his pitiful last attempt to rejoin his interior life to the life of the breathing, living swell of the waves, the earth itself. We have him questioning still, or at least giving his interior monologue still, as he says, "I grow old, I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled." And then, of course, That's the image. We have imagery here. We have the image of the old man on the beach, as they are wont to do. They roll up the trousers and step into the water, right? So he is in a last pitiful attempt, stepping into the water. Is he committing suicide? I don't know. But certainly there is a death of some sort, as we find out in the final word, not even just the last line, the last word that appears is drown. So we end on this word, drown, and we tend to want to feel despairing. I know that certainly that's been the reaction of my students and myself when I first read it, and when I return to the poem, if I've been away from it for a while, I always have a sort of mixed bag of feelings about the last line in the poem. I love it. I love the poem so much, and I just I tend to recoil from this image a little bit because I don't personally intuit a pessimistic message is here. I don't see, despite everything, despite modernism, despite the criticism, largely, and even the images and the symbols and the text being a sort of slow walking death itself, I refuse to accept that this is a pessimistic poem. I cannot accept it. And so we end on this word, drown. And by golly, I can't let it be just a final word of a sort of final tolling of the bell, if you will. I don't see it that way, and I'm going to tell you why. My reason is simple. It is simply that we have a shift. We have practiced TP cast before, right? So the S in TP cast is shift. What shift do we have in the final line of the poem? Well, we have a pronoun shift. The whole poem has basically included a litany of I statements with the occasional reference to they and them, and we have third person and first person, and we have therefore subjective I statements and questions. Do I dare disturb the universe? And we have third person they, she statements. In other words, completely removed and away from and in the dark about others. In the final line, we have we drown. Human voices wake us. We have the inclusivity of the totality. The speaker is somehow reborn into the oneness with the sea, the earth, the mermaids, emblematic perhaps of a magical or metaphysical sense of being that is sudden in its movement and in its appearance, and then just as suddenly is gone again. I think it is of great significance that Eliot chose to end his poem with just this shift. Other support for the thesis comes in the form of allusions and metaphors in the poem. Even the epigraphical content of the poem is lifted straight out of Dante's Purgatorio, okay? Dante's Purgatorio, Purgatory, as you probably know, is the state of in between heaven and hell. It's almost a non-place in which the souls of the not yet forgiven linger. Okay, so again, the lingering, the hesitating. We have this frozen mindedness, this stuck in transfixiation of sense of being stuck in one place, unable to do anything about it. This is the how the text begins before it even begins, with a passage quoted straight out of Dante's Purgatorio. So there in the epigraph we have an allusion. Other allusions, again, we have, no, I'm not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be, am an attendant lord. So allusion to being sort of the figure in the background behind the hero, the tragic hero in the case of Hamlet, letting soot, right? So there's the soot that falls, all right? So lets the soot fall, right? So there's this, everything is happening to me because I'm unable to do anything or act in any way. It's a sort of bibliophilic figure. He's obviously a well-read person to make the constant references to other works of literature from history. So he's the proverbial bookworm, and this is causes him great grief. Somewhat, I can at least speak somewhat from experience that this is a side effect of having your nose in a book all the time. As you feel, there's an element of feeling alienated in your intellectual pursuits, and this is part of what it is. This is part of what it means to be J. Alfred Prufrock, right, the speaker. And so we can look to metaphors and allusions. Other metaphors, again, the slinking cat imagery at the beginning, the going up and down of staircases in a cyclic fashion, seems to almost allude to a Sisyphean crisis. So Sisyphus, the mythological figure, doomed forever to roll the stone up the hill only to watch it fall down again and then repeat. So we have these patterns of repetitiousness and folly, conceit, but mostly it's really a sort of futility. So we have a person whose thoughts are like daggers in his soul, and when he does act, he feels that he is an observer. He's not actually a part of anything, right? So he's always just an onlooker. And in fact, in the chapbook published in 1917, one of the first publications of this poem was called Prufrock and Other Observations. So we have this almost eternal observer figure, one who never actually enters into what is being observed and doesn't participate. He's a non-participant, a callow non-participant, until the end, which I've already described. The ending shows him doing something finally. Now, the irony is that he's old, so he's let his youth pass by him, and life happening while life was happening to everyone else, he just watched it go by. And as he watched the men leaning out of windows, he watched people, but he never did any, he never made the effort to commune with them in quite the same way that he does at the end with the mermaids. Okay, so he finally resolves to do something. He resolves to go and meet in the chaotic sea that's blown around. We have the washing cleansing and the act of cleansing and purification, almost like a kind of baptism. He enters the water, and with the mermaids, he drowns, right? So he's like, it's irony. It's absolutely ironic. He, in finally quenching the thirst in his soul, he drowns in it. He drowns in his like his whole life has been leading up to this point. He's desired communion with others to have a rapturous, ecstatic joining of his own being with the being of that which is here and yet beyond here, right? The mermaids, again, is this magical? Is this just a simple, is it really just suggesting a metaphysical presence, like the presence of God, the presence of spirit, something, some kind of spiritual materialism here? Eliot did cite Andrew Marvell, the metaphysical poet Andrew Marvell, as a significant influence on his writing. So maybe that is what we have here. In any case, we do have movement from beginning to end, and the speaker invites us, the readers, along with him in the beginning, potentially. Maybe he's not talking to us, but he does say, "Let us go then, you and I." And again, later, "Do not ask what is it, let us go and make our visit." So it's almost like he's speaking from beyond the grave. Maybe he does drown in the end. Maybe this is him trying to, like the ghost of Jacob Marley, extend a warning to those of us who are still around, and something along the lines of a carpe diem entreaty to we the living, saying, "Let us go. Stop hesitating. Don't be like myself in life. Don't wait around and watch your life pass you by. Let us go and make our visit. Let's go and get involved in the world and in what's going on. Don't read about it in the newspaper in your parlor room while you're smoking all the time. Just go and live." Maybe that's the love in the